This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on today's show, a grand jury declines to charge the officers involved in the fatal shooting of 12-year-old Tamir Rice. We'll hear reaction from Mumia Abu-Jamal. An activist in Australia unabashedly erases advertising in public spaces. And we go to a California public high school, where a chorus program is empowering and engaging youth. From artists to athletes. Those stories and more on FSRN's weekly edition. Black Lives Matter protesters are vowing to take their demonstrations into the new year, saying police shootings of unarmed civilians continue with little progress toward police accountability. Policing scandals have fueled demands that Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel resign. Emanuel cut short a vacation in Cuba this week to return to the Windy City, where he announced another round of police reforms.
We announced that any officer involved in shootings will be put on desk duty for 30 days so we can assess their fitness for duty. That's a change from 3 days. I also directed Interim Superintendent Escalante and acting head of IPRA, Independent Police Review Authority, Sharon Farrelly, to review the crisis response policies that are in place so that we can see what needs improvement and what needs to be changed. Today, we're taking additional steps to create more time and distance in these situations and other encounters to make environments safe and safer for all. We will improve communication between officers and individuals to make these encounters less confrontational and more conversational. And we will double the number of tasers to 1,400 while also providing officers the training to use them properly.
Those calling for his resignation say the reforms amount to little more than damage control for the embattled mayor's administration. Chicago protesters accuse Emanuel of trying to block the release of video that shows the 2014 police shooting death of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. The dash cam video reveals that Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke fired 16 bullets into McDonald, some of which were shot after the teen had collapsed to the ground. The video was made public by judicial order after a lengthy Freedom of Information Act request process. Only after the video became public, prosecutors charged Van Dyke with first-degree murder and official misconduct, charges to which he pleaded not guilty in a court on Tuesday. In his press conference one day later, Emanuel suggested that if officers had tasers in their patrol cars, perhaps police would have had an option other than deadly force. The announced reforms come on the heels of the police killings of two other African-American residents of Chicago last Saturday, including a mother of five. Protesters point to those killings as evidence of a systemic problem within the police department, while city officials called the incident a, quote, tragic accident. The Cleveland, Ohio police officers involved in the shooting death of 12-year-old Tamir Rice will not face criminal charges related to his killing. Earlier this week, Cuyahoga County Prosecutor Tim McGinty explained why his office recommended the no-bill decision to the grand jury considering the case.
The Supreme Court instructs us to judge an officer's conduct by what he or she knew at the moment, not by what was learned later. We are instructed to ask what a reasonable police officer with the knowledge he had would do in this particular situation.
In November 2014, officers responded to a call outside a recreation center where Rice was playing with a BB gun. The dispatch came after a 911 caller identified Tamir as someone who was probably a juvenile playing with a fake gun, but whose actions were frightening nonetheless. Assistant County Prosecutor Matthew Meyer repeatedly referred to Rice as, quote, the suspect, and showed an enhanced version of the grainy video of the shooting, saying that a forensic video specialist concluded that Rice was reaching for his waist at the moment the officers arrived on the scene. Meyer says this led officers to believe they faced an immediate threat.
The 911 operator never told the dispatcher about the possibility that Tamir was a juvenile or the gun was a toy, which led to the two responding officers to believe that a real man with a real gun was threatening innocent people's lives at a recreation center.
A statement released by the attorney representing the Rice family alleges Prosecutor McGinty manipulated the grand jury process to ensure no indictments against the officers involved. The family adds they were saddened and disappointed by this outcome, but not surprised. Shortly after the decision was announced, Mumia Abu-Jamal filed this response from Pennsylvania's Mahanoy State Prison.
When a child dies, news break. Cleveland officials announced no charges to be filed in the police killing of 12-year-old Tamir Rice. There is something shattering about the death, the killing of a child. When a child dies, the natural order is torn, the stars weep, and the earth quakes. We have become so accustomed to this system, we suppose it is natural instead of a human imposition. Politicians in the pocket of so-called police unions bow before bags of silver and blink away the death of a child, especially if a black child. What man-made institution is more precious than a child? What job? What so-called profession? What office? What state? When a child dies, adults don't deserve to breathe their stolen air. When a child dies, the living must not rest until they have purged the poison that dared harm such a one. When a child dies, time runs backward and attempts to right such a wrong. This should inspire movements worldwide to fight like never before. For something vile has happened before our eyes. A child has been killed. And in America, because it's a black child, it means next to nothing. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to FSRN, Free Speech Radio News, independent, non-commercial media. To find out how you can support FSRN, visit our website, fsrn.org. A new wage theft law takes effect in California on the first day of 2016, making the state the most recent to take legislative action on the issue. California's Senate Bill 588 allows regulators to go after property owned by employers convicted of wage theft. New York has also dedicated more resources this year to pursuing wage theft claims, with the governor forming a 12-agency statewide special task force for exploited workers. And in Connecticut, beginning October 1st, employers caught stealing wages must now compensate workers double the wages owed. A workers' rights group in New Haven is hoping the law will help many low-wage workers, especially immigrants, who are the most likely to suffer from wage theft. Melinda Tuhus reports.
Connecticut's Department of Labor recovered over $6 million in stolen wages for more than 3,800 workers last fiscal year, according to the department's most recent statistics. That was just before a new state law came into effect, which could require proven offenders to pay workers double their stolen wages. Gary Pesci, Director of Wages and Workplace Standards for the Connecticut Department of Labor, expects the new law will cut down on wage theft by creating a penalty for violators. Pesci's office has hired three new investigators to pursue wage theft claims. Under the new law, some violators can avoid the double pay penalty if they can show the underpayment was not intentional or they don't have the ability to pay it. Previously, even multiple offenders faced no penalty.
There's still always those bad eggs, those bad actors out there that we have to keep an eye on and just have no intention of complying with the law. And those are the ones that are paying cash off the books, using undocumented workers, which doesn't matter to us, but it does when they're exploiting them and making them work many hours at a less than minimum wage and paying no overtime and paying cash and really treating badly. So we still have a number of those we're working on, which is just a travesty in this day and age.
Pesci's office has hired three new investigators to pursue wage theft claims. Under the new law, some violators can avoid the double pay penalty if they can show the underpayment was not intentional or they don't have the ability to pay it. Previously, even multiple offenders faced no penalty.
Christmas!
One employer who has grabbed the attention of both labor officials and local activists is a mafia-themed Italian eatery in New Haven called Goodfellas. The state and federal departments of labor found on 7 separate occasions the restaurant had cheated workers out of minimum wage, overtime, and/or final paychecks for a total of more than $40,000. In May 2015, 6 more former workers sued the restaurant, alleging wage theft, harassment, and intimidation. To draw attention to the allegations, members of Unidad Latina en Acción, the New Haven Workers Association, began picketing the restaurant. This led to the arrest of one of the group's leaders in early December, a first in 10 years, after New Haven police responded to a noise complaint from a patron. Organizer Joe Foran noted that in the past, New Haven Police Chief Dean Esserman vowed to follow up on complaints of wage theft against the restaurant, but recently crossed a picket line to eat there.
Why, then, did Chief Esserman 2 weeks ago arrive for an important meeting to the Goodfellas restaurant, sit down and eat at Goodfellas restaurant, cross right through our picket line, and say he couldn't speak, he didn't have time to speak to us? And then 2 weeks later, just by coincidence, one of our members was arrested for peacefully assembling the same way we always have.
A 2009 national survey of 4,500 low-wage workers by the National Employment Law Project revealed that 2/3 of them had experienced at least one pay-related violation in their previous work week. And data from the U.S. Department of Labor shows just how pervasive a problem wage theft is. In fiscal year 2014, 109,000 low-wage workers in areas such as agriculture, healthcare, and hospitality were awarded a total of more than $79 million. By far the biggest offenders were restaurants. Sidey Gebrselassie, an attorney with the National Employment Law Project, says filing lawsuits or working through state or federal labor departments can bring results, but both approaches often take years.
That's why there are, in recent years, a lot of state and local governments that have taken it upon themselves to pass additional laws to try to guard against wage theft. So whether it's a law that's, you know, there are some laws now in cities across the country that will actually revoke a business license or suspend a business license for businesses that are repeat violators of wage laws, you know, as a way to really provide an effective deterrence against committing wage theft. And there are other localities that make it easier for workers to file claims.
Repeated calls for comment left for Goodfellas owner Gennaro Iannacone were not returned. Law students from the Worker and Immigrants' Rights Advocacy Clinic at Yale Law School are representing the 6 workers currently suing Goodfellas in federal court. They are awaiting a judge's ruling on the defendant's motion to dismiss their case, and in November participated in mediation talks at the State Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities regarding the workers' claims of discrimination on the basis of race, national origin, and sexual orientation. Given the length of time needed to investigate and pursue wage theft claims, the full effect of the new law and its tougher penalty may not be apparent until the State Department of Labor publishes its statistics for the current fiscal year. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, New Haven.
The holiday season is observed in a variety of ways. For some, it's a time of reflection. For others, it means time off from work or school to spend with family. But one element has become a constant, a barrage of advertising. Many people engage in rampant consumerism, and others tune out the ubiquitous marketing messages. But Johnny Blacarley reports on one Melbourne man's mission to beat back the onslaught of advertising in public spaces.
It's 2 o'clock on a Friday afternoon in Melbourne's busy financial district. Armed with a bucket of glue and hundreds of sheets of black paper, a man walks up to the electronic billboard at a tram stop. Slowly and methodically, he begins pasting black pieces of paper over the ads.
My name is Kyle McGee, I'm 32, and I think the first time I went out and painted a billboard, I was 21. So I've been doing this off and on since then.
Adbusting is a form of protest that involves altering commercial advertisements. However, unlike regular adbusting, often done at night and in secret, Kyle does his out in the open, in broad daylight. After covering over the advertisements, he also posts a piece of paper outlining his philosophy and linking to his website. He isn't hiding at all.
Why do we accept constant for-profit advertising in our public spaces and across our media? We pay for it, we suffer it, and we let it manipulate the defenseless minds of our children.
He says authors such as Naomi Klein and Noam Chomsky helped him articulate his thinking about media and society, but he wanted to take it to the next level.
Yeah, I guess I found it frustrating that all these academics had written these awesome books about how the media is corrupted and all this, but they were unwilling to do anything other than publish books. That is, you know, something, but in light of the consequences, I think we should be trying to do a little bit more than that. I mean, to engage the mainstream on these subjects instead of just preaching to a niche of liberal-minded people, you're going to have to take things into the physical realm, start living your ideas a bit more, standing up for them.
But standing up in public has had its costs as well. McGee has regularly been arrested and charged during his protest and has been to prison for short stints on several occasions. His most recent hearing was at the Melbourne Magistrates Court, where he was charged with the crime of willful damage and posting bills. Recording isn't allowed inside, but McGee admitted openly to his actions. However, he refused to do community service or pay fines, and the judge sentenced him to 7 days in prison. His friends, as well as his three-year-old daughter and her mother, were in the courtroom to support him.
But having my daughter there had a really big effect on me that I didn't expect. You know, I got a sentence of only 7 days, but because my daughter was there, I just looked at her and it just made me want to cry.
A few weeks later and he was out of jail and out posting again. McGee lives in squats and doesn't have traditional employment. This protest is his job. Out on the street, he works covering half a dozen billboards at the tram stop, as several of his friends film and take photos. Onlookers express mixed reactions.
So what do I think? Oh, he's got a right to have his opinion, doesn't he? Do you think people are going to get it, though?
Do you think?
I think it certainly shows a level of commitment to the stand he's taking. I don't know if there are many people in the 21st century who are prepared to go to prison for what they believe in, certainly not in Australia.
I mean, I guess we're set, like our world is saturated with advertising and we can't escape it. And that's not great, that's not really a choice. Like if you want to escape from advertising, what do you do? Where do you go? Like buy your own private island? I mean, it's freedom of speech, like you shouldn't go to prison for freedom of speech. Damaging property that's like in public, so I think it, you know, why should advertisers be able to pay to push their message in our faces, and public citizens who are just out and about in the city, which is should be their home, aren't allowed to do the same.
Protest is one thing, but to do something that's not to do property that's not yours, that's another. Well, I'm sure there's other ways to get your message out. You know, people get messages out all the time without having to do this.
He's been sent to prison before for doing this.
No,
do you think that's a fair response?
Well, clearly it didn't teach him a lesson, did it? If it did, well, he wouldn't be doing it again.
Media does what it does, and he's finding his way of doing it, but he's got to find a legal way of doing it, not like this.
Oh, look, I think, look at the kind of advertising that we get with betting syndicates and all those kind of things. It's just disgraceful and, you know, they just prey on the weakness of human beings, and I think it's fantastic what he's doing. Good on him.
And so he's been doing this for about 10 years.
Has he?
He's actually been sent to prison a few times.
You're kidding. It's incredible, isn't it? You can be in a bank and take people's money and destroy lives, but this guy can make an honest assessment of society and get put in prison. It's crazy, isn't it? It's the world we live in, unfortunately.
The police don't come on this particular day, and after postering over about a dozen billboards at the tram stop, McGee and his friends head off. He is adamant that he will continue this protest as a form of civil disobedience, saying he can't be himself without doing what he cares about. Johnny Blackali, FSRN, Melbourne.
FSRN comes to you free of corporate underwriting or advertising dollars. Listener support is crucial to our continued broadcasts. Find out how you can support our work. Visit our website, fsrn.org. California has one of the strongest policies on arts education in the country. But despite a state law that requires public schools provide access to arts education, many aren't doing so, saying the funds simply aren't available, particularly in disadvantaged communities. The California Legislature's Joint Committee on the Arts recently met to examine the status of arts education in state schools. According to the Los Angeles Unified School District's Arts Equity Index, only 35 out of the 639 district schools received an A for arts education. State and local leaders hope that as the economy improves, so will investment in school arts programs. But the reality, says Director of Arts Education Partnership Sandra Rupert, is that the decision to fund arts programs comes down to the individual district and, in some cases, the individual school. FSRN's Karen Argood visits the Napa High School campus in Napa, California, to see the impact of just one arts program.
Walking through the halls of Napa High School, a public high school in downtown Napa, with a student body of 1,900, it's easy to find where the boys' chorus class is. You just listen. The freshman boy energy is tangible in Voice 101, taught by teacher Travis Rogers. With more than 35 years teaching at Napa High, Rogers knows just how to harness their teenage testosterone while encouraging and empowering these young men to sing, for most of them, for the first time in their lives. As the class begins, he sets the tone during warm-up and doesn't waste a minute establishing order.
Who's playing policeman today? Nick. Anybody talks? Drinks? Eats? Take him right up front. Got my authority. Kayla, you get to be it next time. How's the weather? How is the weather today?
That's when Rogers calls on one of the boys to come out in front and police his fellow singers. That means making sure their hands are down at their sides, they're focused on Rogers' directions, and they're engaging the audience both visually and vocally as they perform. And what happens if they catch a student breaking the rules? It's 10 push-ups. Rogers has a twinkle in his eyes.
The push-ups are just a very gentle way of making sure that, hey, we're all doing the right thing.
The Napa Valley Unified School District funds his salary and provides the choir room for the program. And they even received $3,000 from the school site budget this year, which was a first, says Rogers. But it's surprising what it costs to run a chorus program. He says sheet music for 1 year costs $20,000. And Napa's not a wealthy district, so most of the funding comes from private donations, concert ticket sales, and donations made at performance gigs. Marcy Atkinson is development director at Napa's nonprofit Aldea. She says that even though the median income is high in Napa County, there is significant income disparity.
Meaning there are a good proportion of people that are very poor, and then there are people that are very wealthy at the very top that kind of skew the median income.
The district is comprised of more than 30 schools serving about 18,000 students. More than half are Hispanic, and 44% qualify for free and reduced meals. According to a study by the Lucille Packard Foundation for Children's Health, 43% of Napa County children live in households that earn less than the self-sufficiency standard, meaning their families don't earn enough to afford basic housing, food, childcare, transportation, and health care costs. Annie Petrie, the principal at Napa High, says the chorus program is open to all interested students, irrespective of their singing ability.
What comes to mind is walking a student down to Travis. Maybe it's a new student that enrolls from another school. Maybe it's a ninth grader who has yet to find success in school or hasn't connected. And walking that student down to see choir so that they open their mind to take it on and watching Travis interact with that student and really take any kid. And that sticks in my mind. What fuels him the most is taking the kid that has never sang before.
Like 14-year-old Chase LaRue, a freshman football player and wrestler, it's obvious that LaRue is an athlete. He's small, but muscular and lean, with a bleach blonde crew cut.
Well, at first it was kind of nerve-wracking. I mean, just singing in front of faces that I don't know and haven't met yet. But then once he started going, then we like became a family and we really can sing to each other and stuff like that. It's just a fun time. And most of the football team does it, so I can't explain it. More like how to like calm down. It's like just nice, calm thing and just relax and have fun. I mean, yeah.
Jairo Garcia, a tall, lanky junior who has been in choir since he was a freshman, elaborates.
Say you're having a bad day or something, like you don't really want to talk to anybody, but in choir, you're kind of forced to sing. But once you start getting into the songs and start getting into the lyrics, it kind of just, everything else really floats away because you're focusing on one thing, and it's a joyful thing.
Roger says that they go after the athletes. Typically, more than 80% of his singers are athletes. And Petrie adds that much like athletics, Mr. Travis creates a team atmosphere in the classroom.
He has high expectations for kids, which is what we want in every classroom. But he does that in a way where they're part of a team. And it's the same reason why kids go back and play sports after working really hard and grueling workouts. They do it because they're a part of something, and that's what Travis creates.
According to a study by the National Endowment for the Arts, arts education bolsters students' achievement and contributes to stronger participation in school activities. Napa High has the largest enrollment of male singers at a public high school in the United States. Of the 350 students, 190 are boys.
Tomorrow shall be my dancing day. I would my true love give me some chance to see the legend of my play.
And it's not only the athletes or the artsy kids on the fringes that the choir attracts. As Rogers, the program brings all types of students together, students who likely wouldn't otherwise interact.
Perhaps the strongest thing, though, is the community that it builds. The fact that everybody's is accepted and in, that any type of kid can walk in that door and they have a place they can do well and be accepted. And that's been the great joy in teaching us, seeing kids discover they can sing, that it's okay to sing, that it's cool to sing, but more importantly, that they find a place where they're safe and where they're valued. It's been the magic here.
Junior Jairo Garcia says there's a level playing field in the choir room.
We treat each other as equals. So all that maybe racism and otherwise criticism just kind of floats away, and then we all get along together.
We teach a functioning society in that room. We're in need of that with our kids. Music should be required just as much as English and as math is, because in the hands of good professionals, you can create something that's just exceedingly special.
Karen Argood, FSRN, Napa.
And that does it for this week's program. Shannon Young provides editorial services from Oaxaca, Mexico. Robert Packard provides technical support from WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Music in today's show is Boogie Belgique via Jamendo.com. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram, wishing you the best in the new year.